Well, turn again then, please, in your Bibles to Mark's Gospel, chapter 5. And we're looking at this passage that I read earlier on, verses 1 to 20 of Mark 5. Now, when we think of Mark's Gospel, we think of brevity, don't we? Mark doesn't multiply words unnecessarily. He doesn't fill his pages with padding. He isn't prone to verbal diarrhea. Mark is an economic writer. He specializes in stripped down accounts and bite-sized narratives. That's what maintains the pace and momentum for which this book is so well known. And what immediately surprises us, therefore, about this narrative is its length. Matthew devotes 7 verses to this incident. Luke devotes 14. Mark, however, devotes an astonishing 20 verses. There's a level of detail here. There's a volume of description here that's pretty much unparalleled in this gospel. And that presumably indicates the significance Mark attaches to this incident. In his mind, it's clearly related very closely to the whole message, the central message of his book. He really wants us to take this narrative on board, and hopefully as we proceed this morning, we shall see and understand how that's so. Well, I want us to approach this passage then by way of its main characters. I want us to look at some of the characters whom we encounter in Mark's story here. And first of all then, Satan. That's the first one, Satan. And this is verses 1 to 5. Now I hear you immediately protesting, but Satan is never mentioned. And that, of course, is perfectly true. But what we do have in this passage is an evil spirit, verse 2. Demons, verse 12. This isn't the first time we've encountered such things, is it, in Mark's Gospel? Nor will it be the last. They're a fairly familiar feature of the book. They're part of the furniture, you might almost say, in many of its narratives. And Mark is always matter-of-fact in the way in which he refers to them. He doesn't encourage an unhealthy curiosity in his readers. He doesn't offer any kind of demonology. This book is not Screwtape Letters. He doesn't attempt to explain how these evil powers operate, what their relationships are between themselves, how they organize themselves, that kind of thing. He doesn't go down that route, except that is for one passage which tells us everything we need to know about these evil powers. We've referred to it several times before in this series. It's chapter 3, verse 27, where the demons which Jesus is there being criticized by his opponents, being criticized for driving out, those demons are described by Jesus as the strong man's possessions. The strong man's possessions. The strong man can only be Satan. In other words, demons and evil spirits are Satan's possessions. They belong to him. They are under him, his agents, his servants, his representatives, doing his work and promoting his cause, so that it is legitimate to identify Satan here in this passage this morning. Behind the activity of these demons that we encounter here is unavoidably the activity of Satan himself. Where they are active, he, by definition, is active. They are his possessions. He is their boss. He is their master. And we can guarantee, therefore, that he is active where they are active. Satan's presence, I'm saying, is written all over this passage. And having established that then, what I really want you to notice is the sheer ferocity of his influence here. The sheer ferocity of his influence. In The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, There's that Satan-like character, isn't there, called the White Witch. And those of you who've read the book will remember how she strikes up that relationship with the boy Edmund. And she endears herself to him by supplying him, you remember, with Turkish delights. And Edmund then is thrilled by all this confectionery, and he falls into a completely naive view of this woman. To him, she's this kind and charming woman. To him, she's enchanting and captivating. He has the highest possible regard for her, and it's only when, much later on in the book, he finally ends up in her castle. And there in her courtyard, sees all those stone statues. It's only then that he suddenly realizes what this woman is really like. It's only then that he realizes that this smiling dispenser of Turkish delight actually turns people into stone. And we can sometimes be hopelessly naive in the way in which we think about Satan, can't we? Okay, we're not perhaps quite as naive as Edmund. We know that he's bad. We know that Satan's a tempter. We know that he doesn't have our best interests at heart. We know all that stuff, but we're not absolutely horrified at the thought of him. We're not deeply perturbed at the thought of him. We're not profoundly disconcerted at the thought of him. There's this complacency about us often, isn't there? This failure to take Satan really seriously. And you see, Mark chapter 5, verses 1 to 5 here, are addressing that tendency within us. Just as Edmund looked at those distressing stone statues in that courtyard and suddenly began to appreciate what the White Witch was really like, these verses here are saying to us, look at this distressing man here in the region of the Gerasenes and understand and appreciate what Satan is really like. Appreciate what he really wants to turn human beings into. Appreciate that he isn't out just to toy with human beings and to mess around a bit with human beings and to play a bit with human beings. He wants to turn them into the kind of disturbing, distressing figure we see here in Mark 5, verses 1 to 5. And perhaps you say, well, this is a bit extreme, isn't it? We're dealing here with a very unique and extreme case. This man is multiply possessed by demons. And yes, okay, that's all true. But surely we are here being given a little window, a little insight into where Satan really wants to go with people. Let me put it this way. When you entertain that fleeting, spiteful thought about another person, I hate that person, Satan doesn't at that point go away celebrating like he's just won the lottery or something. No, he wants to make you such a spiteful, unneighbourly, antisocial being that in the end you will separate yourself from society altogether and live on your own amongst the tombs. When you entertain that fleeting, hedonistic thought, I just want to go and drink myself into a stupor tonight. Don't think that Satan at that point goes away celebrating wildly. No, he wants to make you so abusive toward your own body that in the end you'll be cutting yourself with stones. When you entertain that fleeting sexual fantasy, don't think that Satan at that point goes away celebrating. No, he wants to make you so utterly shameless that in the end, like this guy, you'll be wandering around without even any clothes on. I'm saying we're being shown here the kind of ambitions, the kind of desires Satan has for us. He doesn't do things by halves. He isn't content with small gains. He doesn't set himself modest targets. He isn't easily pleased. This is what he wants to do to us. And this is why then the New Testament is so strenuous in its warnings to believers. We were looking at them in timeout last Monday evening. 1 Peter 5:8 and 9. That the devil is that roaring lion. Resist him, Peter says. James 4 verse 7, the same language. Resist the devil. Ephesians 4, 26 and 27. Paul talking about anger. Do not give the devil a foothold. Why? Why this serious language about being vigilant and watchful toward the evil one? Because this is the kind of being we're dealing with. This is the kind of enemy we have. This is where he wants to take you. Please don't be complacent this morning. Don't think you can mess around in the Christian life this morning. Don't think you can be casual this morning. We have an enemy like this one. Satan is the first character we meet in this passage. Secondly this morning, Jesus. Jesus then is the next character I want us to look at. And this is verses 6 to 13. Now I wonder whether you've ever been in a really intimidating situation, or a situation at least where you felt really intimidated. Perhaps at a football match, proudly wearing your own team's colours, you suddenly found yourself amongst the other team's supporters. Perhaps wandering around London without a map, You suddenly found yourself having wandered away from the tourist trails and in one of the city's less salubrious areas. Perhaps driving in your car one day, you suddenly found yourself being tailed by a motorist who clearly had some grievance against you. Perhaps you've experienced that kind of intimidating situation. Well, we need to appreciate here that the scene that we have here in Mark chapter 5 makes all those examples I've just mentioned pale into insignificance. All those scenarios I just mentioned are nothing compared to an encounter with this demon-possessed man on a lonely beach. I mean, this is really calculated to intimidate. I mean, I think the NIV actually obscures just how intimidating the scene is. It misses out the word immediately in verse 2. It literally says, when Jesus got out of the boat, immediately a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This straight away, it's almost as if Jesus is still stepping out of the boat. He's still got one foot in the boat, and already this demoniac is upon him. And then, of course, there's this word legion. What's your name? My name is Legion. And we're not to think that Legion is just a kind of standard collective noun for evil spirits. Nor, I think, is the emphasis here upon numerics, that there are 6,000 soldiers in a Roman legion, so there were exactly 6,000 demons in this man. That's not the point. The point is its military connotations. This is an army of demons that Jesus is being confronted with here. As he steps onto this beach, a hellish army stands before him. This is a profoundly intimidating scene. Many years ago, when my brother was a student in Edinburgh, he was walking along one evening, and as he was walking along, this man came and started walking along beside him and started kind of leaning against him and pushing him to one side. And my brother soon realized that he was trying to push him into an alleyway off the street. And I don't know what you would do in that situation, but my brother took a very straightforward course. He just leant back and pushed the other direction, and it worked, and in the end the man wandered off. And it's a kind of story that is often told in our family, kind of exemplifying the way in which my brother refuses to be intimidated by situations that would intimidate most people. And here we have Jesus in this passage. And the thing that stands out here is that on an infinitely grander scale than that example I just used, Jesus refuses to be intimidated. Doesn't it really show in the way in which he conducts himself? I mean, first of all, notice the way in which He talks to this man. Verse 9, he asks him, what is your name? I mean, it's like You don't know the person who's sitting in front of you in church this morning, and afterwards you say, well, what's your name? And Jesus is talking here to a man multiply possessed by demons, a man who's possessed by an army of evil powers, and he's just saying, what's your name? It's such a refusal to be intimidated. Or then there's the fact that within a few moments, whereas you'd have thought Jesus would be pleading with this man, look, don't do anything to me, actually the man is pleading with Jesus. He's saying, please, don't torture me, verse 7. And then again, verse 12, the demons are begging Jesus, send us into the pigs. It's completely the other way around to what you would expect. And then, of course, supremely, there's the ease and effortlessness with which Jesus drives out all these demons. We've been told in verse 4 that others have tried to chain this man. And here now, we don't have Jesus shouting to Peter or John, can you chuck me some fishing ropes there so we can try and tie this guy up? No. Just speaks to him. Simple words. It's interesting as well, actually, that when the demoniac says in verse 7, swear to God that you won't torture me, he's actually using, ironically, a formula there which was normally used in exorcisms. That people who can use that language, swear to God, that form of words, when exorcising. Here it's the man who needs exorcising that's using those words. And ironically, the one who does the exorcising doesn't. Just simple language come out of this man. No elaborate formula. No incantations. He isn't like the prophets of Baal on the top of Carmel, dancing around in a frenzy. Just come out. And the spirits are dismissed and go into the herd of pigs. Instead, it's a magnificent display, isn't it, of Jesus' authority and power, his refusal to be intimidated, the ease with which he deals with this intimidating situation. And I mentioned then in my introduction that Mark really lingers over this narrative. He really wants us to notice it and to read it and to study it. And I think this is probably why. You see, Mark is very interested, isn't he, in Jesus as the conquering king. We've noticed that motif again and again. That's Mark's dominant angle that he's coming from. That Jesus is the great conquering king, the promised king of the Old Testament, come to crush the serpent's head, to defeat Satan and the kingdom of darkness. And we've said before that on the face of things, it seemed like a very implausible claim. That this Nazarene, this man who goes to sleep on a boat on an afternoon sailing trip, it seems very implausible that he is the promised king, the conqueror of evil powers, the one who's going to bring down the great villain of history, the great wrecker of everything, Satan himself. It just doesn't seem plausible. And what Mark is doing, therefore, is showing us again and again demonstrations, showing us attestations, evidences that he is the conqueror, as he describes to us all these exorcisms, all these occasions on which he drove out demons. And surely this is the supreme one of all of them. This is the ultimate test as to whether Jesus is the conquering king. It's one thing driving out an evil spirit from a man who's calmly sitting in a synagogue in Capernaum. It's another thing driving out a whole army of evil spirits from a man who's naked and self-harming in Gentile territory. If Jesus fails here, it's all a fake. If Jesus can't get rid of these demons, then he's a phony. And there's no redemption through him. There's no salvation through him. All the evils of the world are not going to be overturned and overthrown by this man. There isn't a great hope of a new creation and the restoration of all things, a new heaven and a new earth through this man if he can't deal with this situation here. But he does, you see. He majestically drives out the demons because he is the conquering king. He is the one through whom there is the hope of Satan one day being cast into the lake of fire and a new creation emerging, paradise restored. Do you know this king as your king this morning? Are you on his side? Are you in the army and in the ranks of the great devil crusher Jesus? Are you with him this morning? Are you connected to him? Or are you on the other side, destined to be crushed by him? It's one or the other. Be with him on the victorious side, or be against him on the losing side. Jesus is the conquering king. Satan, Jesus, thirdly this morning, the local people. Verses 14 to 17. So the man is healed, he's restored, and obviously this gets heard about and all the local people turn up. And of course, having turned up, they're so admiring of Jesus and they bow before him and they own him as their king. We want to be your disciples. We want to serve you the rest of our lives, they say. Well, not quite. Instead, we have that astonishing and very solemn statement in verse 17. The people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. These people come, see the evidence of this miracle, see the evidence of the conquering king at work, and they plead with him to leave. I think it brings two or three things to our attention. First of all, notice their flawed taste. Their flawed taste. They can look now at this man sitting at Jesus' feet in his right mind, talking sensibly, thinking clearly, clothes on, his modesty restored. They can look at that scene that's so decent and orderly, and they can actually find it in themselves to prefer the former scene, when he was cutting himself and living amongst the tombs. There's this flawed moral taste in them. They preferred the old man to this new man. They preferred the raging lunatic to this calm, healed, restored disciple. Some of you may have read C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce, and the whole underlying premise of that book is a strange and an unbiblical one. He seems to be saying in The Great Divorce that hell and heaven are not final destinies and that you can go from one to the other. And as I say, at that level, it's obviously profoundly unbiblical. But there's a lot in that book that nonetheless is very sane and insightful. And not least this, the fact that in Lewis's scene there, the scene that he constructs, that these people, this busload of people from hell, come to heaven and have the opportunity to stay there, but actually, most of them decide they don't want to. Most of them decide to go home. And I think at that point, Lewis is correct, in the sense that he's identifying there our default setting, the default setting of these people here. Those people in the Great Divorce could look at hell and look at heaven and say, we want hell. And these people here can look at the man in his raging state and look at the man in his restored state and say, we prefer the former. There's a flawed taste in these people. Secondly, there's a flawed logic. Because you'd have thought that even assuming that first point, even assuming that they preferred the demoniac in his former state, you'd have thought that logically they might have concluded, well, if Jesus can do this, if Jesus has such power as to be able to overthrow this legion of demons, then we better just surrender ourselves to him. There's not much point in asking him to leave the region. That's not going to do us much good. We're not really going to be able to get rid of him from our lives, from our eternities, from that day of judgment when we shall be summoned before his bar of justice. If he's that powerful, if he's that great, then the only wise and sensible option, even if we don't really like it in our inner taste, the only wise and sensible option is to surrender ourselves to him. But there's none of that logic. They see this man with power to drive out legions of demons, and they think that they can just kind of push him back across the Sea of Galilee and never have to meet him again. It's ludicrous. It's illogical. It's irrational. Flawed logic. Thirdly, notice their flawed priorities. Because another factor, surely, in their desire to get rid of him is what he's done to the pigs. That's Mark adds, doesn't he? Verse 16, those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. And of course, the pigs represented their livestock, so that their livelihood. The pigs represented their income. The pigs were their capital, their assets. And Jesus had just gone and ruined their assets. He'd just gone and bankrupted them. And that was all they could think about. That was all they could see. A herd of pigs was more valuable to them than their own souls and their own eternal destinies. A herd of pigs was more important than Jesus Christ. Their priorities were completely upside down. And this then is the picture that we're given of these local people in the region of the Gerasenes. A flawed taste, a flawed logic, and flawed priorities. And there's nothing unique and unusual about these people. It's every man. This is the human race. This is our default setting. This is how we're born into this world. This is our nature as Adam's descendants. This is what happened to us as a race in the Garden of Eden. We became diseased. We talked about this last week. The disease of sin that is gnawing away at our souls. This moral disease. And these are the symptoms. A flawed taste. We prefer evil to good. A flawed logic. We think we can somehow avoid and evade the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And a flawed priority. We prize trivialities over weighty eternal issues. And this is why, if people are going to respond to the gospel, only God can make it happen. You see, our words, our witnessing, our evangelism, in and of itself, it isn't going to save people who have this kind of taste, this kind of logic, and these kind of priorities. People aren't going to suddenly drop everything and bow to Jesus Christ and Lord and as Lord and Saviour just because we've told them that that's who he is. No, people have too deep a problem to do that. And only therefore through the awakening work of the Spirit that we sang about in our opening hymn this morning, only through him regenerating, making alive, only in that way is faith possible. And this is why evangelism must always be accompanied by prayer, by utter dependence upon God the Holy Spirit. It's why we must pray every bit as much as we speak. Speak to God every bit as much as we speak to people. Because without his work, without his influence within, nobody with this kind of disease of the heart is going to become a Christian. Satan, Jesus, the local people, fourthly and finally, the former demoniac. The former demoniac. This is verses 18 to 20. So he's been restored now. He's spent a while sitting at Jesus' feet, but now it's time, because of the pressure of the local people, it's time for Jesus to get back on the boat and leave. And the man then wants to go with Jesus. It's an understandable impulse. But we have then Jesus' response in verse 19. Go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. Jesus instructs this man to go home. And I think that's significant. And as we close, and let me just mention two ways in which I think that's significant. First of all, it points us to the outworking of the gospel. The outworking of the gospel. Here's this man, and he presumably had a family. Jesus told him to go home. Whether he's a young man, and it's his parents that he's going to go home to, whether he's perhaps got a family of his own children and wife, and it's that kind of home he's going back to. We don't know, but he has family. Go home, Jesus tells him. And Isn't it wonderful to think about that? That all the years, that family must have just been grieving over the brokenness in their home. Where's Johnny today? Oh, he's out amongst the tombs. He's cutting himself. He's naked. Nothing we can do about him. The heartache, the sleepless nights it must have given those family members, the state that their beloved parent, spouse, child, whatever it was in. And here now Jesus comes along and he heals the broken home. He restores the broken family. He sends this man back home. You see, we hear so much, don't we, in our own society today about the great plague of broken homes, broken families. Our politicians don't know what to do about this. They're up in arms about it. It came to the surface so powerfully in August, didn't it? Those riots on the streets of London. Parents not even knowing their kids were involved and certainly not able to do anything about it. Broken homes. Streets where the same man is father to several children in several different homes. We're in a chaotic society where the nuclear family has been so ripped to pieces. And our politicians then throw all kinds of programs, all kinds of money, all kinds of rhetoric at the problem. Never seem to get anywhere. And yet the idea that it's the gospel that's needed, the idea that it's Jesus Christ that's needed, of course that would be immediately dismissed, out of the question in our politically correct society. But that's what we're being shown here. That Jesus changed this man, and the result was a healed family. Of course, we know in other places Jesus talks about how he came with a sword to divide families. And that's an important truth as well, that the gospel can have a dividing effect where there's opposition to the new convert in a family. But the gospel can also have a family uniting effect. That's what happens here. The man goes home. It's the gospel that our society needs more than anything, with all its broken homes and broken families. So the outworking of the gospel. Then the second thing to notice here is the ordinariness of the Christian life. The ordinariness of the Christian life. I wonder if you've seen those adverts for the army, and it makes you tired just watching them, doesn't it? They kind of have people being lowered out of helicopters and racing across fields with armed to the teeth and all the rest of it, and it all seems so exciting. I'm sure that if you did join the army, it wouldn't all be as exciting as that. And perhaps we can have a concept of the Christian life like that. You become a Christian and you go out to the mission field and you immediately just drop everything and get involved in some kind of full-time Christian ministry, and it's all very exciting. You join a Christian organization. You go around speaking at events. It's all that kind of thing. And that's what this man wanted. He wanted to go with Jesus. He wanted to be part of the apostolic team. And Jesus says, no, that's not your role. Your role is just to go home. Go home and live out your Christian life amidst the ordinariness of your family, the job that hopefully you'll be able to get now and hold down now. Just normal routines, normal days, normal weeks. That's where you've got to live out your Christian life. And again, of course, there's a sense in which the Christian life is by definition extraordinary. We're supernatural people in communion with the living God, indwelt by the Spirit, united to Jesus Christ. Of course, it's extraordinary. But I mean in the setting that we're to live out our lives. For most of us, it's just normal working weeks, 9 to 5, in the factory, or in the classroom, or in the office, and then at home with the family. And it's in that context that we're to tell others what the Lord has done for us. It's in that context that we're to seek to sow seeds and seek to tell people about the mercy and grace of God in Jesus Christ. And sometimes perhaps we struggle with this idea of ordinariness. We want it to be a bit more radical. But for most of us, this is the life. Remember Paul's words. I've quoted them often before to you. 1 Thessalonians 4:11. Make it your ambition. What? To go out on the mission field and sacrifice your life for Christ? Well, perhaps for some, yes, of course. But for you Thessalonians, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your hands, just as we told you. And for most of us, that's the instruction we need to take home with us. Jesus saves us and then tells us to go home. Amen.